I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, about damn time, one of Seattle's newest council members shows what it looks like to stand up to the mob. Plus, we'll have a recap of those three hearings on the Let's Go Washington initiatives, and Senator Mark Mullett joins us to talk about pushing back against his own party's priorities. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. A special thank you to Undivided subscribers who help support the work that we're doing, which I think is working because we saw something in council chambers in Seattle yesterday that I never thought I'd see for the rest of my days on this planet. And that was a council member with a backbone, not only standing up to the mob that has put this city into the dirt, but also encouraging a police response to unruly protesters in council chambers who are stopping the city's business from getting done. Let me paint the scene for you with a little help from our friend Jonathan Cho. So we know that there have been some demonstrations at Seattle City Hall in recent months over refugees and asylum seekers who are demanding housing, or rather advocates on their behalf, are demanding that the city step up to the plate and just roll out the red carpet, give them housing, give them everything they need, just like they're doing in New York. So Jonathan Cho is there, and he, you know, as Jonathan Cho is, he's up there, got a cell phone, filming things. The entitlement of this crowd was insane. And we'll talk later how they were interrupting the council meeting, being very threatening toward council members, but Jonathan Cho's presence is just too much for them to handle.
Don't touch me. Don't touch me.
We feel harassed.
We feel harassed.
The council members take a recess. So this starts outside. It's very hostile. There's individuals, as usual, trying to block Jonathan Cho, saying they feel threatened by his presence. Again, huge sense of entitlement. And then they go forward and act threatening toward council members, interrupting the meeting, saying no more money for police, give money to refugees and asylum seekers. So the Seattle City Council ends up taking a recess because things are completely out of control, and this mob in council chambers, as we've seen many times over the last decade, refuses to allow them to proceed without interrupting. So at one point, the mob has basically been told, you've got to go outside. You can't be in council chambers anymore, which I think is a really good start to actually say, no, you can't do that in here. Sorry, you've got to leave. So the council comes back in to try to finish its business. And they're talking about a really uncontroversial thing in this moment. It's like naming a street after someone. And Councilman Tammy Morales is trying to do this. And you will hear some of the mob that continues to stand outside the council chambers, which if you've never been, it's this hallway with this big glass wall, so you can see in from the outside. You will hear, as Tammy Morales is speaking, them pounding hard on that glass until one of the newest council members, Kathy Moore, decides to speak up and say she is not going to tolerate this from the mob.
In 2022, Lehigh opened George Fleming Place Apartments at Othello and 43rd. The building includes 100...
President, I'm going to take a point of personal privilege and request that we have police response. Our physical safety is being threatened by the actions of the demonstrators outside banging on the windows, which could easily get broken, and we will have a mob scene. I'm asking for police presence to arrest those individuals.
I mean, you hear that insurrection.
It's
anyone?
More than loud. It is a physical threat to the safety of each of us on this council, and it is a threat to the operation of our civic institution and I want the record to be clear that I physically feel threatened. I don't know about my colleagues. The business of this council has been unnecessarily interrupted. It continues to be interrupted. It is not appropriate, and this action needs to be recognized. And we need to make sure that this does not happen going forward. We are shutting down the operations of our democracy because of a mob action, and it is not to be tolerated.
Yes, girl. Yes, Kathy Moore, District 5. We love it. About damn time. And look, I'm all for. I want elected leaders to listen to their constituents, but there are plenty of opportunities to show up at council chambers as many other people do and have your voice heard. Or write to your council members, request a meeting with your council members without showing up as this same activist mob has done in the city for 10 years and yelling and screaming until you get your way. And usually they do get their way. We've seen that many times in the past, whether it's on taxation, unreasonable taxation, whether it's on police and defunding. You've seen council members give in to the mob. Well, not today, socialists. And I think one of the interesting aspects of this, we'll get to the arrests. Oh, yes, the Seattle Police Department actually arrested members of the mob in Seattle. Is this Christmas, Nicole? Can you check the calendar? Is it my birthday? I just feel overwhelming joy. So the Seattle City Council put out a statement which confirms something that I suspected, which is these aren't refugees. These are, you know, the Stop the Sweeps crowd, Defund the Police crowd, who have just moved on to the latest thing that they want to riot over. So this is a Seattle City Council statement on the council meeting. It said, there was a disturbance during today's council meeting. It was resolved so the council could get back to conducting the people's business. Today, that included honoring the late Senator George Fleming. The resolution was unanimously passed by council and his family was present to receive it, which is also embarrassing. Like, you're honoring this person with something so simple and you have this mob scene going on. It says, to be clear, that disturbance was caused by a group of protesters and not refugees who the city of Seattle has been working with to provide shelter. This was confirmed, I think, by our friend Jonathan Cho, who actually blasted out the names and pictures of the six individuals who were arrested by the Seattle Police Department. And these are the same folks. These are the people who are always hanging around at whatever the cause of the day is for the far left. One of them, and I don't know if this is an updated or an old bio that's still on the UW website, but one of the people arrested, his name's Aiden Carroll. He's got a bio up on the Community Environment and Planning College of Built Environments at UW. Let's read it, shall we? And he was arrested criminal trespass in the first degree. So he's shown booked into jail. Gee, Adam, you don't look like a refugee. It says, Aiden Carroll is passionate about affordable housing, climate action, here it is, decolonization, disability rights, ecological rewilding. This guy sounds like he'd be fun to go to dinner with. Geography, history, and horizontally organizing with consensus-based voting, among other things. He's thus very glad to have found CEP with its look at how we can create the city of the future and focus on how the people in that community will interact and live. He works at the Urban Native Alliance in his free time, ha, literally says that, in his free time, parentheses, ha. He can be found bicycling, reading, singing, thinking about mental health, and agitating for social justice. So, I mean, on the UW site, he's agitating for social justice. Hey, he's telling the truth. Well, you're agitating for social justice got you arrested yesterday, Aiden Carroll. I hope it was worth it to you. So the Seattle Police Department put out a blog post about this. Six arrested after disruption in city council chambers. And the Seattle Police Department kind of goes through the course of the defense events and their decision making. It says officers were called to Seattle City Council chambers around 2:55 p.m. as people filled the room and continued to interfere with the session. Those who were part of the disruption were told to leave the chambers, but they refused and were told they would be arrested if it continued. After being warned and refusing to stop, three men and three women were arrested for criminal trespass. One of the men was also charged with obstruction. Many others in the chamber left without any issues. City Council were able to resume the meeting after the arrests. And one of the brilliant things here, the six arrested were booked into the King County Jail. which is remarkable. I mean, it's hard to get anyone booked into the King County Jail. But you know what this was? I guarantee behind the scenes, Ann Davison, the Seattle City Attorney, bless her heart, she has said and she's tried to work with the jail to get certain people booked, even on misdemeanor crimes, for instance. So I don't know if there was some behind the scenes like, you will take them. You will absolutely book them into jail. I imagine that there was. So six of the regular old riot mob in Seattle who will show up and scream to get their way about just about anything had to spend at least a little time in the King County Jail. I think that's a positive development, and I give a lot of credit to Councilwoman Kathy Moore for standing her ground and saying, no, we're not just going to ignore it. We're not just going to let them sit out there and bang on the glass while we try to go about our business. It's threatening. I feel physically threatened, she said, and I want the police here. Amen, girl. Oh, amen. This is what we need to see because, look, again, I go back to it's the same people. Once you just get the same people, I don't need them to shut up. Like, look, if they're Seattle residents, they have a right to have their voices heard. But they need to do that in a way that doesn't interfere with the rights of other people to have their voices heard. This particular group is not willing to do that. So they need to be taught a lesson. If that comes with arrest, booking in jail, criminal prosecution, by all means, that's what it's going to take. But at the very least, I had said when the new council members were elected and it's sort of this more moderate majority that time would tell whether they were willing to stand up to the mob. Remember, I said that because we saw Councilman Andrew Lewis, who he campaigned on, oh, the police are great, funding more police. And then he caved to the mob 6 months later and voted to defund SPD. So I said, time will tell if these new council members are willing to stand up to the mob. Well, it took about 2 months. But now we know that they're willing to stand up to the mob. And that's going to be a very good thing for the city of Seattle. All right, let's move on to a recap of the three Let's Go Washington hearings that happened this week. Man, I love to see this level of civic engagement. Around 6,000 people registered their support for each and every one of these initiatives. There were a few people who registered con. I like to think that those people were simply confused and they thought it was they were against the policies. You know,
they
I think there was probably a little overlap. Or they were their cronies at SEIW and WEA. But that's fine. Like I said, I want you to. I love this is all about giving people a voice. And I would not be doing my job or consistent with my values and the values of the show if I said I only want people to have a voice if they agree with me. That's ridiculous. I love that we have these hearings to let both sides come out and say, yay or nay, here's my rationale. But one of the cool things about this, and I've never seen it in Olympia, there were lines and ropes for people to wait in line to get into a legislative hearing.
That's awesome.
The political nerd in me loves that. Man, I'm feeling so positive today. What a great day. So I loved that, that people were standing in line well before the hearings to make sure that they got a seat. And of course, so the way these hearings work, they were joint hearings. So you had senators in there and representatives of the House and Senate joint hearings. And then you would have staffers come in and they would brief the committee on the ins and outs of the initiatives. And then they allowed testimony, both pro and con. So that's how that works. So what I want to do is go through each of the three hearings. They're done now. The last two happened this morning. And just play a little of the pro and con arguments. I tried to choose ones that really summed up, generally speaking, what the support of the initiatives was at the hearings and what the opposition to the initiatives would be. A big theme from Democrats during these initiatives was that we don't really need this. These initiatives aren't going to do anything anyway. So that was a big theme that they were putting forth. Let's start with the initiative that had the first hearing, which was on no state income tax. Representative April Berg, a Democrat, argues that it's simply not necessary.
So just from my understanding, does this impact any existing taxes or any existing tax structures, statutes?
Madam Chair, there is nothing in the initiative that explicitly suggests that there is an impact to existing taxes. The text of the initiative contains no language evidencing whether or not this applies retroactively. Moreover, the initiative does not affirmatively amend or repeal any existing tax statutes. There is a rule of statutory construction that the courts disfavored implied repeals of existing laws. Therefore, based on these grounds, it is more likely than not a court would determine that the initiative applies only to future enacted taxes and does not implicate any existing state or local taxes.
And that's a common argument you've heard, is why do we need a no state income tax initiative when the state constitution restricts an income tax in Washington state? Well, our friend Steve Gordon, who showed up to testify in favor of this initiative for the group Concerned Taxpayers of Washington, he explained that, I think, very well.
Realistically, this initiative should be unnecessary, given that both constitutional precedent and the people have been very clear on multiple occasions. Washingtonians do not want an income tax. However, obviously 450,000 people decided that they needed to make that message clear. And with the polling that I'm sure many of us have all seen, this has been popular. And if you look at the pros and cons for signing today, it's overwhelmingly folks in favor of this. So why is this initiative necessary? Well, it's because taxpayers don't necessarily feel that they're getting value in return for their tax dollars. Crime is up and educational attainment is down. Homelessness and addiction deaths have skyrocketed, while affordability for the basic families has moved further out of reach. Again and again, the response from Olympia has often been, if we just had more tax dollars this time, we could really fix it. Well, taxpayers are waking up to the fact that the problem isn't more money for government, it's a need for better policy. So this lack of trust is really the reason that this initiative is necessary and why it's supported by so many Washington taxpayers. The people want to say as clearly as possible, enough is enough. Give us control of our checkbook back from the state.
Yeah. And as he said, it's really about let there be no room for confusion. You know, there's already been this misinterpretation of the state constitution in pushing through a tax on capital gains, which every other state in the union and the IRS say is an income tax, which would be unlawful in the state of Washington because it singles out one group of people, but they did it anyway. So this initiative is about codifying into state statute no state income tax. We don't want a state income tax that is blatantly called one. We don't want a tax dressed up as something else, so we don't think it's a state income tax. No state income tax. So let's move on to the hearing on the Parental Rights Initiative, which, again, the theme from Democrats on the committee was we already value parental rights in education. We don't need an initiative to codify that. Here's State Senator Lisa Wellman.
We all know that family members are every child's first teachers. And I think we can agree that creating an educational system that welcomes and embraces parents and guardians as partners in the education of their children is crucial. State and federal law already grant parents and guardians many rights in furtherance of creating this partnership between our schools and parents. However, it's become clear that it's confusing to understand the full scope of parental rights and already exist because they're not easily accessible or published in one space. I believe you'll hear from staff in their briefing how probably over 90% of the rights included in this initiative are already current law.
Yeah, we already value parental rights. This coming from a senator who just last week rejected an amendment that sole purpose was to keep pornographic content out of our schools.
We need to move forward. I'm asking for a no on this this amendment. And so let's say all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Nay. The amendment has failed.
Yeah, Senator, you can't convince me that you care about parental rights when you rejected an amendment that will make it harder for parents to try to keep sexually explicit materials out of the hands of their kids in our public school system. But thank you very much for trying. On the pro-parental rights initiative side, we heard from Melissa Petrini, who's also a friend of our show. We have good friends who are out there doing the business. So Melissa Petrini, she's a Highline school board member. We had her on the show because she was, of course, being attacked while she was running for school board as, oh, some crazy right-wing lady. She's a mother of six kids. And in fact, she goes by the screen name in the undivided comments, Mama of Six Rocks, and she testified in favor of the parental rights initiative.
I'm here as a parent of six children, one with autism, one with Down syndrome, others with other educational needs, and here hoping to make our schools a safe, inclusive, and equitable, and academically strong place for our students to thrive in. I'm here to speak in favor of House Initiative 2081. I also want to help To help make it happen, we need to continually work to build bridges of trust with our parents and communities, especially at a time of high mental health issues, depression, and record-breaking suicide among our young ones. There's never been a time more than now where we need to work together to bring about the best solutions and perspectives from all sides, listening and learning from one another, and trusting parents to have access to important information that will help them support their own children. This initiative seeks to strengthen parental knowledge and engagement and to promote equitable access to any and all information to help their children mentally, socially, physically, and academically thrive. This initiative seeks to promote inclusiveness of families of faith and differing sexual identity attitudes and to trust parents who know and love their children best. This initiative will also make historically marginalized groups have confidence in speaking up on behalf of their children and their family values. This initiative will give parents the tools and information they need to help and understand those children who are categorized into an elevated high-risk group for mental health and suicide, can then be more proactive in watching for signs to help mitigate and intervene, which could save their children's lives. To leave parents in the dark about elevated risks would be negligence, and the liability would rest upon the schools and the state for not partnering with parents fully. When our students have support from all sides, parents, teachers, and society, they will thrive in school, in their home environment, and regain confidence in the future they choose. Thank you. I hope for your support.
Go, Melissa. Go, Melissa. It's just common sense stuff. We talk about it on the show all the time. No more of these laws that and these policies in schools that assume the worst intention of parents. Having parents actively involved, aware of what their kids are going through, having no secrets between teachers and parents, that's best for the child. I mean, if you have an abusive parent or something, there's laws for that. And that should be the only instance where important information about what's going on with your kid is kept from you. Common sense stuff. So let's move on to a recap of the final initiative that got a hearing this morning, and that is the initiative to restore reasonable police pursuits. Brian Haywood, of course, with Let's Go Washington, who helped to push these initiatives, I think he summed up the purpose of this initiative very well.
I'd like to thank the committee this morning for giving us a chance to voice and give voice to the 434,000 people that signed this initiative and the over 5,000 people that signed in pro. This was never intended, sometimes it's portrayed as being something about a 250-mile-an-hour chase through a neighborhood in the middle of the afternoon. That's not the intent of this initiative. This initiative is, first and foremost, to restore local jurisdiction over making the rules on when a chase or a pursuit should occur. As has been noted earlier, this would not prohibit certain jurisdictions from having stricter controls than other places. We're completely fine with that. But what's happened with the current law is that we've had, first of all, an increasing disregard for the law. You get citizens that feel like if they won't pursue a criminal who steals a car, then why should I obey the speed limit? That is a bad precedence to put into a society. Number two, it begins a mistrust of the police. This is not good for any society throughout time. Number three, it demoralizes the police workforce. Had an opportunity to speak with WAC cops, and I saw on their faces the complete degradation that they feel for being victimized or made the bad guys for all the problems that are occurring, but not being allowed to go and fix it. Number four, there is an increase in crime in general, but specifically there's an increase in car theft. We have become the nation's leader in car theft. We should not be the nation leader in car theft. There's no reason for this, because what car theft has become is a getaway free car system. As that has happened, finally, then we've had skyrocketing increases in our car insurance rates. This is a direct result of an increased car theft caused by the inability of the police to pursue bad guys when they've done bad things. And I hope we'll hear testimony from the Gold Aides today, there has been more than one case of loss of life that's resulted because bad guys that could have been caught were not put away and they were allowed to go on and commit more crimes.
And it's impossible to argue that all of those things are happening. You turn on the TV, you'd follow anything, you know that everything he said there about increase in car thefts, obviously that's occurring. There's no way to deny it. As a result, increase in insurance rates, et cetera, and then loss of life. So this is an initiative that has pretty strong bipartisan support, because there were already some Democrats who backed away from what they did with police pursuits in 2021, realizing that it had wider implications than they truly understood. Although there are clearly some Democrats who are still opposed to it. Let's check in on what the opposition brought to the table during this particular hearing. Here's Representative Tara Simmons.
I am curious, in the last couple of days, there was some new research put out around the increase in police discretion also increases racial profiling. And I was wondering if you're aware of that research that was released within the last couple of days, and is there anything in this initiative that would account for that, or take the fact that that research showed 4 times more likely for Black people to die in vehicular pursuits than white people? And I was wondering if there's anything in this initiative that's going to take that into consideration.
So Representative Simmons, I'm not immediately familiar with the research that you're citing to. What I can say about the initiative is that nothing in the current statute nor in the initiative specifically describes taking into account racial disparities. There's no language in the initiative that would specifically identify and address that particular concern. The language in the initiative is, again, as Joe and I have mentioned, just specific to language changes for those two aspects of our current statewide policies.
Yeah, shocking that the opposition would make this about race. But I think that Representative Tara Simmons actually said something there that if some right-wing commentator were to say it, they'd be called racist. To say that increasing police discretion in pursuits would have a disproportionate impact on people of color is to say that more people of color would flee from traffic stops. Because when you're talking about these instances where a police officer would try to pull someone over, they drive away, chances are they don't know the color of the skin of the person behind that car. How would they know if the person fled the traffic stop? So without knowing that she's acknowledging it, she's basically saying we have more Black people in this state who are fleeing from law enforcement. Now, if that's the case, you want to try to get to the bottom of it. But certainly she's acting like it's police that are the racist ones that, oh, when you're trying to pull over a car, you need to, like, I don't know, call it in and say, hey, here's the license plate. Who is this car registered to? Can you tell me the color of their skin? And then I'll decide whether I should pursue them or not. That's ridiculous. A couple things. So we're going to talk in a moment about where these initiatives go from here. So what's going to happen? They've got a hearing. What's next? I would say on the arguments from Democrats in the first two on no income tax and parental rights, where their primary argument was, well, these don't really change anything. Okay, then adopt them. If they don't change anything and they're just feel-good initiatives, then you should have no problem in the world adopting them. And on the third one, again, you already have Democrats who've been trying like hell to fix this thing because some of them actually realize that it didn't help. So it should be a no-brainer. But we do know that one state lawmaker, a Democrat, at least, is in support of all of these. State Senator Mark Mullett, he's a moderate Democrat. He's also running for governor, but we spoke to him this morning in his capacity as a state lawmaker. And he was part of the committee for two of these hearings, parental rights and no income tax. And he joined us not only to talk about what happens now, but also to discuss some of the other bills that some of his progressive colleagues are not so happy with him for killing. Senator Mullett, welcome to Undivided.
Hey, happy to be back.
Yeah, so first let's talk hearings. You were present on the committee for two of the hearings, the income tax hearing and parental rights this morning. What were some of your takeaways?
I think my prediction is these bills are going to pass in the next week. I think both those bills, the committees I'm on, I expect the committees to move them out of the committee on Friday. I think we could have a floor vote on all three initiatives early next week. Monday or Tuesday is my best guess at this point in time. But I think they have the votes to pass. Obviously, Republicans are supporting them. And I think there's enough Democratic votes supporting these initiatives that I expect them to get to the finish line before next week.
Is there a strategy there for Democrats who've been very critical of this entire initiative effort, some of them? Is there a strategy there to at least, like, throw voters a bone on three of them?
I mean, I think that if the initial plan was vote no on all six, I think they realized, like, these three are so immensely popular with the public. It would be hard to say vote no against all six of these when people right away are going to be like, well, I definitely want police to have the ability to chase after criminals that are trying to drive away from them. So I do think you have a point there that there is a logic of narrowing it down to the core three, where I think they feel they will have financial backing on their side to try to go against the initiatives, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, because you mentioned these three are popular. I mean, the others are pretty popular as well, you know, getting rid of the hidden gas tax, as they call it, the tax that's being levied at the pump due to the Climate Commitment Act. Of the other three, are there any that you personally would have liked to see the legislature pass?
Well, I voted against the long-term care payroll tax in 2019, and I voted against the capital gains tax in 21. So to me, I'm looking forward to seeing how the people I represent, when they get a chance to vote on those same initiatives, how they vote. Because I felt like I was representing, you know, the middle of the political spectrum, the average person in the district, not the extremes of either the left or the right when I voted against those. So it'll be interesting to see. But I'm on record publicly supporting those two. And I'm still trying this last week of session to try to fix the Climate Commitment Act bill. I'm, to be candid, I'm not having that much success getting my fixes to the finish line, but I'm trying.
Yeah, you had, I think the first time we had you on this session, you talked about the desire to do that and at least try to salvage some aspects of the CCA. So what have you not had success doing in sort of fixing it? Because I think the biggest complaint from your constituents is going to be the gas increases. So what were you doing to try to rectify that?
So the success I did have this session is we finally have $30 million going out to Washington farmers who weren't supposed to be paying the markup to begin with. And they're going to hopefully start getting those rebates this fall is the hope. Where I didn't have success is changing the underlying bill to allow it to be a more gradual process so it's not so painful for consumers of the pump. And I think that's the challenge. I think Ensley has this false narrative, in my opinion, that if you're complaining about gas prices, that means you don't care about climate change. You know, I have solar panels in my house. I am the first legislator to ever drive an electric car to Olympia. I care about climate change, but I also don't understand how we as Democrats can acknowledge that average working families can't afford to live here if we don't actually pay attention to the price of gas.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it for me has been the dishonesty. It's like, if you think this is the right policy for the right time for Washington, just own the consequences of it and tell people, hey, this is worth you paying a little more at the gas pump. It's the lies that bother me. You know, people will know I'm a constituent of yours. I get your mailers. You had a good one we talked about on the show that said, hey, we can help the environment, like you said, without hurting the working class. How do you think Washingtonians, I mean, how do you think this initiative to repeal the CCA will fare, given that they haven't shown any willingness to fix those impacts?
I mean, it's going to be really interesting. I think the one who has the highest probability of passing is the long-term care payroll tax, like making that optional. I think that one, I think I have the highest degree of confidence will get to the finish line. I think the other two are going to go down to the wire. I think you'll have big pushes on both sides of these arguments, and it'll be interesting to watch in November. Hopefully this gets people paying attention and engage in our elections this year.
Will you vote to repeal the CCA?
I have zero confidence that Bob Ferguson will do anything different than what Jay Inslee has done, which is he will just drive up prices as high as possible. And so if that is the case, where if I'm looking at, you know, a chance of Bob Ferguson being governor, like, yeah, I would be extremely uncomfortable with that possibility.
Yeah, I want to talk about, I know that it's, excuse me, sort of taboo to talk about what happens in caucus. So, you know, do what you need to do with this answer. But we talked on the show yesterday about how there was a Senate Ways and Means Committee meeting, which you're on.
Yes.
And you guys emerge into caucus and come out, and June Robinson says, hey, we're not going to take action on this, 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 and this. And there was sort of this solemn sort of tone in her voice. So we've already detailed for folks what those bills were: juvenile offender points, rent control, which was certainly a big one, off-year elections, and then police prosecutions. My understanding is you were opposed to all of those. So what happened in that caucus room, Senator?
I don't know if this is good or bad, but this is the reality, is your most important speeches as an elected official is the arguments you make in private when people are really trying to decide whether they're going to support a bill or not. And so everything that happens in the committee or on the floor of the Senate, that at that point, if you have anxiety about legislation and you don't want it to become law, by the time you're voting on it in committee or on the floor of the Senate, that means you've already lost your arguments. And so I do try to go into those meetings with as much knowledge as humanly possible on the different topics to explain to my colleagues why I think these proposals might not be good for the average Washington resident. And I make those arguments. And, you know, it was, I think in those cases, on those bills, I think the arguments resonated, and it resonated because I think they have validity.
Did they resonate, though? I mean, how many no votes were there in the Democratic caucus on those things?
And that is a place where I am never going to reveal that. I just, as I think people have looked at the math of that, it's a 14-10 committee. And so if Republicans don't like an idea and two Democrats have anxiety about the proposal, this isn't baseball. The tie doesn't go to the runner. If it's a 12-12 vote in committee, that means the bill doesn't have the votes to pass. So, and I'm not going to go into any specifics of that, but I have been comfortable sharing that I was not comfortable with those four bills you mentioned. And I have been public in my position. It's up to other people if they want to be public of what they were thinking or not. I'm going to respect their privacy.
There has been a lot of angst on the progressive side of your caucus about the rent control failure specifically. Do you have any indication that leadership would yank that out of Ways and Means?
That is 100% not happening. That bill is not, is not happening. That bill is not coming back this session. I think that was a highly, we had to do that on police pursuits last year, and I was involved in going around to get the signatures to actually pull a bill out of committee, but this is not happening on this case. So people shouldn't have that anxiety. I think they're creating false drama on that front. I know that legislation will be back next year, and so it's going to be up for debate again. I still feel strongly that it could lead to fewer houses getting built in our state, which just puts more upward pressure on housing prices. And so that is going to be the political tension on that bill when it comes back again next year.
False drama? Politicians? No. Never. Absolutely not. I did hear, though, from a House Republican lawmaker that when you did that in Senate Ways and Means and helped to kill those four bills, I was told that over on the House side where your bills are running right now, that there were some petty efforts to try to maybe take them down a peg. Have you heard that?
That's factual. I think that, and I've been doing this. My experience is every session, you have to be able to walk away from all of your bills. If you're going to let good public policy be hostage of your own personal bills that you're trying to run, you're not actually working for the state of Washington. And so I go into every session, whenever people threaten my bills, I say, listen, I don't care what you do to my bills. I'm not supporting the rent control proposal because I think it's a bad piece of public policy. And if you need to kill all my bills, kill them. You're not hurting me. You're hurting the underlying policy in those bills and the things they could do for Washington residents. It is beneficial. And if other people want to be that petty, then they can be it. But I've never supported a bad piece of public policy just to try to keep my bills alive. That just, to me, is when the whole process starts to break down.
Yeah, I know you need to get off to do the people's business, but I have one more question for you. There is a bill that's still out there lingering. I'm not in favor of it. I don't believe that you are either. It would pay striking workers unemployment benefits. Where does that stand? I mean, when are we going to find out whether that is a go or not?
It has until Friday at midnight to pass. So basically, we're down into the home stretch. I think the purpose of the Unemployment Insurance Fund is to provide support for workers who get laid off through no fault of their own. And I pay into it as a small business owner with my pizza and ice cream stores. I fully support the Unemployment Insurance Fund. It is not there to pay people to go on strike. This is fundamentally breaking the entire reason why we have the Unemployment Insurance Fund. This is fundamentally disrupting. What are we supposed to say to businesses? Move to Washington, so we're going to make you pay for your workers to go on strike? Like, we're not going to be able to attract people to come here. Like, we say we need money for public schools, and it's like, oh, but we have enough money to pay teachers to go on strike? I mean, this is a really bad piece of public policy. And so it'll be interesting the next few days. Like I say, if I'm going to make those arguments to my colleagues around why that bill should not come up for a vote on the floor of the Senate between now and Friday at midnight. And if I do my job well, hopefully it doesn't.
Yeah. And just to the point you made about schools, I don't think people realize this, and I certainly hadn't thought about that. Local school districts would have to foot the bill for their teachers to go on strike.
Literally. Same with cities. Same with counties. workers at cities, counties, school districts, they go on strike. All these places that we keep hearing about how much financial support they need, and yet we're going to pass. I don't know. This is really frustrating, and hopefully smarter heads prevail in these last 48 hours before the Friday cutoff, and we're going to have the discussions. And, you know, it did not pass the Senate the first half, but then the House, I think, realized when it died in the Senate, they sent it over to basically have us redo it all over again. So it's similar to rent control in the sense that rent control failed in the Senate, came back from the House, and then it failed a second time. Unemployment insurance failed in the Senate the first time. Now it's back from the House, and we're going to have another discussion.
Yep. And I, as has been pointed out, a policy so extreme that even Gavin Newsom vetoed it in California. So is that where we want to be?
That tells you something.
Yeah. Exactly. Senator Mark Mullett, well, I mean, I'm always appreciative of your willingness to sort of put good policy above your party. I have to imagine these have been a couple hard days for you behind the scenes and trying to make these arguments, but sticking by your guns is
I've been on your show. I do NPR interviews. I don't think you're going to find another elected official in Olympia that does NPR and Brandy Cruz all in the same 48 hours. So. So there you go.
Very true. All right. Get back to it. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, he's not wrong about that. I do want to note, so since we were speaking to him in his legislative capacity, he can't talk about the fact that Mark Mullett is running for governor as sort of the alternative to Bob Ferguson. And so I followed up with him specific to, as a candidate for governor, about what his position would be as a candidate on the initiative to repeal the CCA. And he said essentially that if he is not the one to make it through the primary on the Democratic side, and it's Bob Ferguson, as he alluded to there, he has no trust that Bob Ferguson would try to give relief to Washingtonians. So he said that he would come out in support of the initiative to repeal the Climate Commitment Act if it's going to be Bob Ferguson, who's going to be the next governor. But he said if he's the one to make it through the primary, he would commit to using the powers in the executive branch to lower the cost of gas. And there are some powers available to Governor Inslee right now to essentially bring more stability to the marketplace. I mean, no governor, not even a Republican governor, could repeal the CCA on their own. I mean, that's why I'd like to see it repealed by the voters. So what they can do, though, is make sure that they add stability into the marketplace to reduce the impacts of the CCA on gas prices. So it sounds like Mark Mullett, if he's governor, would be willing to do that. I imagine a Republican governor would obviously do that as well. Bob Ferguson, not so much. All right. I want to make sure that all of us, including myself and Nicole, fully understand the striking workers bill, because it's complicated when you get into, okay, if you're going to pay striking workers, who's absorbing the cost of that? It differs depending on what kind of employer that you're talking about. So we're going to get into the dirty details of that very, very bad bill coming up next. First, if you have been thinking about starting the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, now is the time, like right now. You know why? I lost almost 30 pounds on that program in just 2 months. And those are the kinds of results that a lot of people see, 20 pounds, 30 pounds. So think about what's happening 2 months from now. You might have a late spring break, just getting into summer. So you could really, transform yourself by the time summer comes along and just feel more confident, more energy, all of that. So one of the things I love about this program is you see the results really quick. They work with you to eat the right foods in the right portions for that 60-day period of time to cut the excess weight. And then by the time summer comes, you'll be on their maintenance program. You'll have the freedom to be able to have some drinks by the pool, you know, go to some barbecues, etc., and it won't be a big deal. So take a little bit of time right now if you've been thinking about the program. Do a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team. Ask all the questions that you have before you commit. But man, there is no better time than before you got to strap on that bathing suit in the summer. No better time to start this program than right now. Okay, as I mentioned, we want to talk about this bill, 1893, that would pay workers to strike. I can't believe we talk about things like this. Think about how dumb that sounds. You're going to pay workers to strike. You know how many more strikes there's going to be? Now, in a little moment of sanity, this morning, the Seattle Times editorial board dropped an op-ed saying that it is opposed to this bill, encouraging lawmakers to vote it down, which I think is good, which I think is helpful. The headline in the Seattle Times op-ed, "Don't extend unemployment benefits to striking workers," and they start the editorial by saying something very obvious. Washington State's unemployment insurance system has a crystal clear mission to provide a temporary income to workers who lost their jobs through no fault of their own. The state Senate should reject a bill that would fundamentally alter that mission to include workers who choose to go on strike. If you choose not to work, you should not benefit from our state's unemployment system. That doesn't make any sense. That gives no incentive for striking workers to try to come to a resolution, be it school employees, other government employees, or in the private sector. So to talk about the impact that this would have on all types of businesses, we asked Bob Battles. He's the Association of Washington Businesses General Counsel and Government Affairs Director on Unemployment Law. We asked him to join us to talk about the ins and outs. Bob, welcome to Undivided.
Thank you.
How's the session been for AWB?
I think if you put in all balance, there was a lot of bad bills. I think you probably know that. But, in the end, many of them did not survive. We still have some outstanding ones that we're dealing with, and some bad ones are still alive. But, overall, it's been a fairly balanced session, although it's been much more aggressive short session than usual. A lot more bills introduced this year than normal that were controversial.
Yeah, it's hard to even think about this being a short session because it has felt long and jam-packed. So let's talk about a bill that is still hard for me to get my mind around, the idea that businesses would have to essentially pay their workers to go on strike. For businesses in Washington state, I mean, what is the impact to them if this moves forward?
Well, you're referring to, of course, Gross Substitute House Bill 1893 that's currently still alive in the Senate. This would have a huge impact for employers. And again, I just want to start with the fact that this is not about whether somebody can strike or not. This is not about whether they have the right to strike. This is about whether you're going to pay somebody to strike. And more importantly, it's about paying somebody using the unemployment insurance fund to strike. And that is a fund that is 100% employer paid. It is a fund that was intended to provide reimbursement for wages to employees who lost their work or lost their job through no fault of their own. A strike isn't that. So this is going to have a huge impact on employers, and not just private employers, but public employers. It's across the board.
Well, and the possibility of not getting paid when you go on strike is sort of one of those incentives to try to reach an agreement to get back in the workplace. So do you believe this will lead to more strikes?
I think it's going to definitely weigh into the decision of somebody deciding whether they do or don't strike. And I think that you will see strikes this next year. We know that we'll see something in the schools, I'm sure. We'll see something in potentially in some of the construction areas. These strikes, that is weighed when people look at that and say, if I can benefit by getting another 4 weeks of pay during that time. So, yeah, I think that it has the potential for definitely doing that.
Yeah. And is 4 weeks the limit under this bill that you could be paid for 4 weeks?
It is. As in its current form, they reduced it down to a 4 week period and that they could have coverage during that time. That's normally the 16 weeks they would have or 26 weeks, but the 4 weeks is what they're referring to.
Would that mean that they wouldn't ever have to tap into their paid leave, like take vacation days or whatever it is, that they could just instead rely on being paid through the UI system?
The UI system would kick in, and again, they would have to still apply for it. It would have all the requirements, but the UI system would kick in. Whether they decided to rely on other systems, I wouldn't know. But they would. And there are some folks that will definitely have likely a strike fund along with this UI system, and not every one of them would reduce their UI payments. And so there's a potential that they could be getting paid twice.
Well, so I want to try to understand the current iteration of this, because my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, my understanding when it was first introduced, it would have socialized the cost of this out, essentially. And now the cost of it is borne by the employer. So talk about how that works for people who aren't familiar with the inner workings of businesses and this system. So if I go on strike and I'm going to apply, I think it's the first Sunday, a week after the strike started or something like that, for these benefits, how much tangibly is the employer out of pocket? Is it the entirety of the wages that are going to have to be paid?
So there's a couple ways to think about this. And okay. So first of all, I would say you'll hear people say that it's after a 2-week waiting period. Well, that's not true. It's after the first Sunday or the second Sunday of the strike, which means within 8 days, potentially you could start getting the benefit. The way unemployment insurance is taxed to employers is there's really three ways, but the two important taxes for you to be, I think you're asking about here, is the socialization tax versus the experience rating tax. The experience rating tax is a tax that's directly attributed to the employer who has an employee getting unemployment insurance in some capacity. A socialization tax is the tax that's shared across the board with everybody. On average, since like 2006, employers have paid about $223 million in socialization costs on average per year. Why is that relevant? That means that it gets paid for by everybody across the board. And this is sometimes due to you can't attribute it to a certain employer. Employer goes out of business and that responsibility doesn't go away. So we have to socialize it in the system. The experience rating is one that actually affects your ratings. However, this originally was set up to be a socialization of it across the board. And if you had a situation where 30,000 people went on strike, which is a potential this year, again, I don't have any inside information, but just, you know, a potential there. That being said, that would be about a $500 million socialization cost in addition to the $223 million. So what happened in the House is they changed it slightly and decided to do it through experience ratings. But this does not eliminate the socialization. And the reason why I say that is this. When it gets to be socialized, when it's experience rating, if somebody caps out, employers are capped out in the system for a tax on experience rating. If they hit that cap, anything above it still has to be paid, and that gets socialized. So in a way, this really doesn't solve the socialization. There will still be people that had absolutely no workers on strike paying it, as well as a huge impact on those employers that do. A third thing that I think you mentioned here about this dollars and costs to employers, there are several employers out there that are what we call reimbursable employers. They don't pay the premiums. They don't pay the experience rating or the socialization. They pay a dollar-for-dollar reimbursement. Every dollar out goes a dollar in. Those are your public sector employers. Those are your schools. Those are your state government. So if they go on strike, there's a direct impact on them, and that's a direct impact on the social fund, or I should say the general fund that we have out there. The problem you have here is in the Senate, this didn't even go through the fiscal committee.
Well, I, you know, the schools to me is the really egregious one, because there's so much talk about school funding and, you know, scarce school resources, and the idea that you could have a local school district that's going to have to pay dollar for dollar their teachers when they're on strike, is, it makes no sense. I mean, Bob, this was such an extreme policy that in California, Gavin Newsom vetoed it. Do you believe that Governor Inslee would veto a policy like this?
Well, we have pointed out that Gavin Newsom and a lot of his reason for vetoing it was the cost to their fund, to their system. And so I cannot say what the governor would do. We would ask that for sure to veto this. But if it moves forward, our hope it doesn't move forward. But again, the cost here is so potential egregious. Let's take this to another cost that like a lot of people are not thinking. We have a lot of transportation projects going on out there. We have a lot of construction projects. We know what happened when we had the cement strike a few years ago in Seattle and how that disrupted many other projects and caused a lot of economic damage to the economy there. This has the potential to do the same thing, because strikes will then be impacted. It's going to delay costs. So it's not just that we can't get the project done in a particular time. It's all the costs behind that and all the impacts behind that. So, this is going to have a problem.
Let's end here, Bob. What union cooked this up? Is this an SEIU, WEA? Who did this?
I can't tell you which union, and I can't say. I know that there is going to be a rally today by labor. Asking for this today, regardless of what union, this is not really about unions or not unions. This is about bad policy for the UI. This is really about businesses paying for their workers to go on strike. And it's about what we would say is a kind of a fundamental misuse of what we think the fund is intended to do, which is reemplace wages to those who lost jobs through no fault of their own.
Yeah, shocking. You mean labor wants there to be a law that pays them while they go on strike? They're going to have a rally today? Oh, color me surprised. Color me. What's the phrase I'm looking for, Nicole?
I mean, that works.
Can you put together a montage of me trying to think of phrases that I can't think of?
I wish I would have started
that a
while ago.
There's like 100 of them. On this, a couple things, action items, now that the initiative hearings are behind us. Please, if you're opposed to this particular bill, House Bill 1893, email your state reps and your state lawmakers. Do it today, because this vote can happen at any moment. It'll die by midnight on Friday. So the next 2 days, 3 days really are going to be critical. And specifically about the cost that this would impose on your local school district. You pay taxes to fund your local schools. You should not want that money. I imagine you don't want that money that should be going to the education of your kids, instead paying teachers to go on strike for 4 weeks. That is insane. So email, call 2 days before it's too late. All right, one other call to action. Senate Bill 6109 is still alive. Let's talk about a good bill for a moment. Could it be better? Sure. But this is the bill that would help protect kids in homes where there's active drug abuse. Representative Travis Couture had he's a Republican. A version of this bill, I think, was a little stronger in that it would make it imminent harm to be using drugs, any kind of illegal drug, around your child. This Democrat version is kind of a watered down version of Couture's bill, but it's still better than nothing. And it would specifically relate to synthetic opioids, so like fentanyl, and it would give a judge a little more ability to weigh that as a potential reason to remove a child from the home. A judge would be told to give it great weight if a parent is using fentanyl, which can kill you in the tiniest little portions, around a child. So this is one that I know the foster families are going to be rallying today, or this Thursday on February 29th, 4 p.m. on the north steps of the legislative building. So you can, if you support this, which it is a pretty common sense policy, like, oh, we should prohibit parents from using fentanyl around their children. Wow, real controversial stuff. So they will be having a rally again tomorrow at 4 p.m. to try to get this thing across the finish line. Come on, all the other stuff that you've been able to do, and you're telling me you can't pass a common sense bill to protect kids from fentanyl. Let's get this done. Senate Bill 6109. So while you're calling your elected leaders in opposition to the bill to pay striking workers, you can also let them know, particularly on the House side, that you were in support of Senate Bill 6109. Okay, coming up next, Senator Marco Elias. There is no shame of this man who continues to spew lies about the Climate Commitment Act. In fact, just as we were in that interview, he was sending out another one. This man has no shame using his government Twitter account to lie directly to the people he's supposed to serve. We'll have just the latest example coming up next. But first, are you familiar with the Leading Economic Index? It's supposed to sort of foreshadow some indicators in the economy ahead of time that the economy might be heading toward a recession. And typically, you can trust that data. What you can't necessarily trust is whether individual media outlets are going to interpret that data correctly. I spoke to our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital about that. Business Insider says a trusted indicator is fueling recession warnings. What you should know about the Leading Economic Index. And then this is from Reuters. Leading Economic Index no longer signals U.S. recession.
Business Insider versus Reuters. Reuters, they threw some junior recent graduate with a journalist degree on that story. Nothing goes in a straight line, right? So even we look at stock markets or even unemployment numbers, you know, when you look at it, it's not consistent. You know, you get this and you get this. So what we look for is trend changes, right? Meaning if I see the line going down like this for unemployment and all of a sudden you get a hot jobs report and it busts up above that line, that's something to pay attention to. We all know who the general media wants to win this year, right?
Yeah.
So I think you're going to see more of that extrapolation. But no, it's all nonsense. If you look at the leading economic indicators, they are pointing recessionary.
Yeah, and so you got to be careful of people who see one good economic bit of news and they're like, oh, no recession in sight, because you're not following trends. And in order to properly manage risk, you have to follow trends. And that's what Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital do. I suggest having a free Know Your Risk portfolio review with Zach and his team. It's a great way just to see if you're overexposed to risk. You've worked hard for your retirement. You only get one of them. Do not put it at risk, particularly this year with all that's happening globally in the 2024 elections. So you can schedule your free risk review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Despite all the stories we've done, calling out State Senator Marco Elias for his repeated lies about what would happen if voters repeal the CCA, he continues to send out new tweets recycling those same old lies because he does not believe that there are any consequences. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Oop. So you know by now this pattern of lies from Senator Marco Elias, who's on the Transportation Committee. He's basically saying if voters repeal the Climate Commitment Act, we're going to lose all this money and it's going to devastate our transportation budget. We won't be able to fix bridges. We won't be able to repair roads. And then, and he continued this morning, he gets into individual projects that communities really, really care about, like widening SR 18, which is critical to the community in Snoqualmie. And he's like, this could be at risk. But none of it is true. So there is a specific set of transportation-related funding that is with money that comes from the CCA, but it is specific to climate-related transportation projects. All that stuff he's talking about, already funded projects like on SR 18, for instance, regular bridge maintenance and road repairs, that's always happened. That's not CCA money. So he's just lying. I honestly think it should be, you should be able to recall someone for using their government Twitter account to lie. It's just insane stuff. So here's one he sent out yesterday that I think is laughable for other reasons. He said, Initiative 2117 would devastate transportation funding across Washington. That includes eliminating millions of dollars to support Washington's Kids Ride Free programs, which allows anyone 18 and under to ride Washington's buses, ferries, and trains for free. So there's a couple things. This is different from his normal lies of, oh, this will go away. This will go away. There is some CCA funding that helps make sure that kids can ride transit for free. But the word, there's a couple things. The word free is doing a lot of work there, Marco. They're not free. Nothing that the government does, no program the government provides is free. Taxpayers pay for it. Taxpayers are now paying for that at the gas pump, whether they have kids that ride public transportation or not. So there's no such thing as free rides. There are taxpayer-subsidized rides. I would also argue, you let a lot of people ride transit for free, and it doesn't seem to change your budget at all. You had a period of time in King County Metro and Sound Transit that because it's racist or whatever, you didn't even check if people had purchased a ticket. So the idea that you're being all sanctimonious about, we have a program that lets kids ride for free, they can ride for free anyway. Just like the homeless people and the drug users do. They ride for free. You didn't need CCA to fund that. But I also, just generally speaking, why are we encouraging kids to ride public transit? I kind of feel bad about that. I wish we had a transit system where I would be like, oh yeah, Susie, like head off on the bus today. I think the bigger issue above making it free would be making it safe. Make it safe. And then, yeah, make it easier for kids to ride public transit. How many stories have we done just in the last month or so about violence on public transit, about the UW assessment that found fentanyl and methamphetamine smoke lingers on all our public transportation vehicles? I mean, unprovoked hammer attack. 17-year-old boy killed a passenger resting on a Seattle bus. Stabbing on a light rail, the man who was just shot and killed aboard a King County Metro bus. I'm more concerned about making transit safe for kids than I am about making transit free for kids. Unbelievable. Coming up next, we'll get to a couple national stories. First, I'm encouraging you to take the First Mark Challenge. All of you need insurance. Don't deal with it yourself. Don't shop around yourself. Don't call the big box carriers yourself and wait on some phone tree when you could have a local company like Firstmark Insurance that is handling all of your insurance needs for you for free. When you take the Firstmark Challenge, they're going to learn about what your needs are, what you need covered, what you don't need covered. They're going to talk to you about your budget, and then they're going to go around to all their carriers that they have at their disposal, and they're going to see who can get you the best price and the best coverage. That's what they did for Mike and I. We are proud members of the Firstmark family. We have been for a year, and this is a company that I am very passionate about talking about. Yes, they're an advertiser on the show, but the amount of time and energy and money that they have saved Mike and I by not having insurance we didn't need, by getting the best coverage we can, I cannot sing their praises enough. Dave Taylor is the CEO of Firstmark. He says this is a really good time to have an insurance broker in your corner.
I really want to encourage folks, don't try to navigate this current market by yourself. Mm-hmm. I believe you need to get with a broker. Okay, obviously I'd love them to come to Firstmark, but at a minimum, they need to be with a broker that works with numerous carriers that can give them the advice they need and really help them navigate this right now, because it's complicated.
Yeah, especially if you have to file a claim and insurance companies are dropping people like hot potato. Is it that? Did I get it right? Dropping you like a hot potato. I don't think that's right. If you have an insurance
claim. Absolutely right.
Is it right? Okay.
Yeah, you want to get rid of your hot potato.
You know, I lack so much confidence because I can never think of the saying I'm trying to say.
Matt, when I know you're right.
Especially if your insurance company is trying to drop you, which happens even for the smallest claims right now, given the environment that we're in. If you have a company like Firstmark Insurance in your corner, they're going to go fight for you. They're going to go to bat for you. And if they can't convince the insurance company to change its mind, they're going to go out to their carriers and they're going to find you new coverage. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you and they do it for free. You never pay them anything. All right, national story I want to talk about. Are you trying to find a way to pay for your food for your family? Is Bidenomics leaving you in the poorhouse? Is inflation making it nearly impossible to put food on the table for your kids? Well, the CEO of Kellogg's has a suggestion for you.
The cereal category has always been quite affordable, and it tends to be a great destination when consumers are under pressure. So some of the things that we're doing is first messaging. We got to reach the consumer where they are. So we're advertising about cereal for dinner. If you think about the cost of cereal for a family versus what they might otherwise do, that's going to be much more affordable. The other places that we like to go is we talk about making sure we have the right pack at the right price in the right place. So having a different size pack that'll have a different price point, that'll take some pressure off the consumer while they're shopping. So those are some of the things that we're doing. But in general, the cereal category is a place that a lot of folks might come to because the price of a bowl of cereal with milk and with fruit is less than a dollar.
I think I also heard the CNBC host kind of giggle.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Oh, yes. He pressed him on it afterwards. Like, he said, really? You're going to try to sell this? And he goes, yeah.
I'm CEO. I'm trying to make money. It's like, can't afford, you know, meat and potato, bowl of cereal. And then I love how he also adds, you can't buy the big box of cereal. You know, buy a smaller box of cereal.
Bidenomics.
Right. What a blessing.
And all of those pictures. I mean, they're all the sugariest cereals you can find.
Can't afford your kids meat and maybe a side of veggies. Sugar will do it.
Fruit Loops. Fruit right there in the name.
Right before bed.
Yeah. It's comical.
Oh, I don't even have kids, and I know that's a bad idea. That's where we are. Yep. I wonder how big of a check the CEO of Kellogg is writing to the Biden administration right now. Okay, let's get to some questions and comments, and then we'll get to our closing sanity check. First, our daily subscriber show poll. I was just curious how many of you actually watched the hearings that happened this week. I asked exactly that. How many did you watch, at least in part, 0, 1, 2, or 3? Now, while I'm flattered that a lot of you said you didn't watch them because you rely on my coverage of it, I expected more people to have actually watched one or all of them.
That takes a long time.
Does it? Are we just nerds to expect that people would watch these hearings? Okay. Yes. Like 80% of people are saying that they didn't watch any, and the rest of you are saying you watched at least one.
It doesn't mean they don't care.
I know it doesn't mean they don't care. I guess I want everybody to be as jazzed as I am.
As long as they put in their little vote, you know?
Yeah. Y says, sorry, none. I'm counting on you. And she also says, also, English still does not automatically come into my ear or brain unless I'm paying a little more attention. Oh, is English not your first language? I didn't know that. So I would not be able to get much done in the house. Let's see. Carenza. I love that name. Carenza. Mm-hmm. I like it. I haven't seen a comment from you before. I was out of town, so I listened to you, but I did register and send my info. Good. Let's see. Captain Cranky Pound says, all watching would do is raise my blood pressure. Yeah, maybe we should absorb that blood pressure increase for you because we want you to stay happy and healthy and be in fit condition to actually be motivated to go vote in November. Linda says, you're watching them for me. You're right, Linda. We are watching them for you. Let's see. I did want to do an update quick. I'll get to Wes here after questions and comments, Nicole, because she's probably like, you're skipping Wes. No, I'm not going to skip Wes. I would never skip Wes. Let's see here. I wanted to give you an update. Where is this, Nicole? Okay, Bill Biz had a $20 super chat. Brandy, you discussed the Northwest Community Bail Fund on Monday. Is the information available as to which organizations or individuals provide the funding? I don't know the answer to that. I tend to think probably not. I'm not familiar with the tax documents that nonprofits have to provide and whether they have to list their donors. I can look into that for you, though, Bill. What I will say, though, and why we started with that comment, we have an update already on the six protesters who were arrested outside the council chambers. The Northwest Community Bail Fund has bailed out five of the six of them, according to Jonathan Cho. The sixth one already had his charges dismissed. Maybe they wrongly arrested him. He wasn't doing what they thought that he was doing. But whatever the case is, it's clear that they felt like there wasn't enough evidence to proceed forward and that he should be cut loose. But Northwest Community Bail Fund bailed out five of the six. I'm surprised because at least one of them was white. I thought they didn't bail out white people. Mm. Aiden.
Well, they don't prioritize. Aiden got lucky. So.
Aiden got lucky.
He did.
So whatever, if that's how you want to use your money. I mean, their bail was going to be minimal, if anything. I think it was like $1,000, which is like $100 or something to
get
out.
I just think it should not be allowed. It should not be allowed because the whole point of bail is to make people show up, give them some reason.
100%. I agree. And yes, we're going into undivided overtime. We got a lot going on here. There's a lot going on. Shelley Rowe says, well done, Kathy Moore, of the new council member who told off the mob. Make this the new normal. I agree. You do that a few times, and things are going to change at Seattle City Hall. I'll tell you what. Eloin Wheeler says, those mob children need a timeout in jail. On the hearings that happened this week, Julie Hafen says, oh, Simmons, you master gaslighter, you. Did you cherry pick data? Did your cherry pick data include the numbers of how many each race were running from the cops? And that's the thing, too, is like, you know, to just say that, okay, maybe the disproportionate outcome is because you have more people of a particular race committing crimes. That's like, oh, you can't say that. I can't say that? Yeah, I can. I can say that. And especially when you're talking about police pursuits, when an officer would have no idea the person who's fleeing from them at high speeds in most cases, you're going to accuse that officer of somehow biased policing? That's ridiculous. Adam Campbell says, I'm not a partner, I'm the boss, the one that pays the bills and the final authority and expert on my children, not up for negotiation. Yeah, I agree, Adam. I think parents should have final say with what's happening with their kids in public schools. On our interview with Senator Mark Mullett, Todd Welch says, it is such a shame that these caucus meetings are in private. I'm sick of both sides supporting this. Yeah, I mean, I'm either way about that. I think as a caucus, there's always strategy and vote counting. And if you're counting votes on the record, you might have lawmakers who are, you know, not willing to be completely honest about where they stand on an issue behind the scenes. So I do think that there needs to be some privacy to be able to do that. But I do understand the point that you're making. Okay, let's read a couple more. On the strike bill, Greg Olakis says, paying someone to strike is about as smart as selling your car for gas money. Yep. Some comments on our sponsors?
Yeah.
Oh, Thomas Child says, I've lost 21 pounds in 3 weeks on Eastside Weight Loss.
Well done.
That's amazing. Yeah. 21 pounds in 3 weeks? Well, you're a dude and
quicker than you.
Dudes lose weight faster, although I lost a lot of weight in 2 months. But am I wrong about this being the perfect time? I'm not just trying to sell it here.
No.
I'm going to Florida in a couple months. Like, if you have something coming up, some sort of vacation, you really need 2 months to make a significant difference. And then maintenance on the program, you're allowed to have your fun. You can have like your Mai Tai, like I said. You can go to the family barbecue. So you'll be cruising into summer looking slim as hell and being able to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
No-brainer. All right, let's see. Okay, a couple more comments on the cereal thing just because it's funny. This American mutt, have you seen how much cornflakes are? I have not. Liz says Top Ramen is cheaper, but also just as not nutritious.
Right. Cornflakes are like probably $7 a box now.
Really?
It's crazy, yeah.
It's been a long while. You know what cereal I really like? And this is going to be completely controversial, and I promise we'll close the show soon and get to sanity check. Grape Nuts. I love them so much. We used to eat them all the time when I was a kid. They're really, like, dense because it's, like, you just put a little cream and sugar on them.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's more of a, I think of that as more of something you add to, like, a granola that you add to yogurt or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Oh, Grape Nuts.
Yeah.
I'm Maybe I'll have some Grape Nuts fan. For dinner. Jeremy C. says, I live on a dairy farm, so milk isn't that bad. I assume you mean expensive, but I do love me some Raisin Bran. Raisin Bran, the little raisins, the little, the chew on them is just
without
right.
Without the raisins? Garbage.
Yeah, I mean,
but with the raisins.
Suggesting Americans should save money by eating cereal for dinner is stupid, but I do love cereal. I don't want to like
treat.
I'm That's not going to diss on cereal.
That's a snack.
One more thing. It was a question, and I just want to clear the record because I think there's a lot of skepticism around elections and stuff. So whenever we have a question that comes in that I can clear the record on, I think we want to do it. So we got an email from Jen. The state is registering young voters. They are sending ballots to kids under 18. I know over 30 kids who are not 18 who have received ballots in Pierce County. It would be interesting to see if this is statewide and how many illegal ballots were sent out and by whom. Those aren't illegal ballots if they're going to be old enough to vote in the November election. So, and when you think about this, it actually does make sense. In the presidential primary, it's a party process to pick who the party's nominee is going to be. So if you're going to be old enough to vote on that person in November, they want you to be able to participate in the process of selecting that person. I actually think that that makes a lot of sense. And it gets people excited to vote in their first election when they turn 18. So if you will be 18 by the November 5th general election, you can vote in the presidential primary. This is from the state's website. In Washington State, 16 and 17-year-olds can sign up as future voters and will be automatically registered to vote when they become eligible. A voter who turns 18 between the primary and the November election can vote in the primary. So you should be able to. Like, I should be able to narrow down, especially in the primary, the list of people who I might have a choice about in November. So I don't find that controversial. So as long as those children you know are going to be 18 before November, there's nothing illegal about them getting a ballot. All
Just
right,
make sure you know who they're voting for.
Yeah, obviously make sure you tell them how to vote.
Yeah.
No, don't do that. Just make sure they're fully informed. All right, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? Some, what? Oh, gosh, yes. Didn't I just say I'd never forget Wes? Wes, I hope you're not watching today. We love our friend Wes Jones. And if you're thinking about selling a home this year at any point, while we wait for the Fed to cut interest rates, get your home ready to hit the market. Wes and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure that your home gets top dollar when it hits the market. Their marketing, their pictures, their video, they're all top notch. And he says that if you're considering selling your home, the sooner that you can reach out to his team, the better.
You know, I've turned houses around in a week or two, you know, that were, you know, that were ready. Mm-hmm. And then there's been others that have really taken 6 to 12 months. But, you know, we have a pretty extensive process. There's a lot of work that we do on the front end. Call me as soon as you're thinking about it. No obligation. I think knowledge is power. So the earlier that you can learn, you know, the better off that you're going to be. And if you decide that it's a fit, then we have more time to prep the house and it's a little less stressful.
Yeah, and that's particularly important if you know that there's some cosmetic updates you need to make to your house. Wes and his team have something called the Listing Boost Concierge Service, where they can actually come in, recommend any updates that they think are going to pay off on the back end. They can manage those projects and they can pay for them up front. How stress-free is that? So check out our friend Wes Jones. Sure, talk to a few real estate agents. Whatever. Do what you need to do. But I'm telling you, when you go to sellwithwes.com and you talk to Wes Jones, you get a market analysis, you're going to be sold on partnering with Wes and his team. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right. Mitch McConnell has announced that he will be stepping down from his leadership role in the Senate. Let's get to it in our closing sanity check. So McConnell is going to be stepping down this from the Associated Press as the Senate Republican leader in November. And he is the longest serving Senate leader, I believe. And look, you know, his age has been showing. We've seen some really, honestly, kind of horrifying clips of him freezing when he's speaking at podiums. So I think that this is no surprise. Let's play a little clip of what the senator had to say when he made this announcement.
But Father Time remains undefeated. I'm no longer the young man sitting in the back, hoping colleagues would remember my name. It's time for the next generation of leadership.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually think that he should probably take it a step further and leave Congress as soon as he can, without waiting for an election, and have somebody else appointed to fill that seat. And this is also the responsible thing to do as a Republican at a time when Republicans are trying to raise alarm bells for President Joe Biden's health and his ability, given not just his age, it's not just about age, and Mitch McConnell talks about father time. Age affects people in different ways. It's clearly affected the president in a big way, and it's clearly affected Senator Mitch McConnell in a big way. And I think that this is setting an example of saying, look, I'm not ashamed to admit that I've gotten a little older, that I'm not the young senator that I used to be, and that I might not be up to the task of being the Senate Republican leader any longer. And President Biden and Democrats would be wise to use this as an example for how they should proceed as well. That has been your sanity check for today. And that has been today's double overtime edition of Undivided. So much exciting stuff. We'll have our final live show of the week coming up tomorrow at noon. If you have not become a subscriber already, please do so. Help us grow this mission and this movement in this critical election year. You can sign up for just $5 a month at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. See you back here tomorrow at noon.